is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. We have our eye on Hurricane Dorian today. The storm is on track for a direct hit on Florida in the next couple of days. The governor there has declared a state of emergency, and residents who haven't evacuated are bracing for heavy rain and wind and major floods. President Trump canceled a planned trip to Poland, he says, because of the storm. Puerto Rico was in Dorian's path earlier in the week, but escaped with little damage there on the island. Now, that didn't stop the president from reigniting a feud with Puerto Rico's political leaders, calling the local government both incompetent and corrupt. We're going to check in on the storms, both natural and political, today on the News Roundup. Joining me is Steve Kornacki. He's national political correspondent for MSNBC and NBC News. He's also author of the book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Tribalism. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Here in the studio is Kelly Jane Torrance, senior editor for The Washington Examiner. Kelly, nice to have you.
Great to be here.
And Reed Wilson is here, national correspondent for The Hill and author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, great to have you back.
Hey, Todd.
Folks, I want to start with immigration policy. There was a lot of news on a lot of different fronts when it came to immigration in this country. The Trump administration declared that children born overseas to some American parents serving in the military will no longer automatically get U.S. citizenship. This is a change in policy. Parents instead will need to apply for citizenship on behalf of those kids before they turn 18. Kelly Jane, this rule change doesn't apply to all military parents serving abroad. Who does it apply to? Who does it not apply to? And why the change?
Yeah, that's the question that a lot of us had when this came out. And I have to say, their reporting on this was very confused at first. When the rule was released, I took a look, read it, the first few paragraphs. I thought, wow, this is a huge change. Then I read further on, became a little more clarified, realized it wasn't. I think some reporters didn't read all the way through. But basically, birthright citizenship is not changing. This is going to apply, estimates have from about 25 to a couple hundred people a year. And basically, if you are adopting a child while you live abroad, this is going to matter to you. If you are a U.S. citizen who wants to give citizenship to your children, but you've never lived in the United States, this is going to apply to you. So it's a few very special cases like that. And it was very confused. You know, people were worried because, of course, Donald Trump has said before he wanted to end birthright citizenship. Why are they doing it? Nobody really knows. Mm.
What if you're a non-citizen member of the U.S. military on a military base, let's say, Ramstein, Germany. You're not a citizen. You have a child on base. What about that child? Is that child a U.S. citizen?
That child is still a U.S. citizen if they're born on a military base, a U.S. military base. They sometimes can claim citizenship. I think actually, though, no, wait a second. Your parent has to be a U.S. citizen.
Confusing indeed.
It is, yeah.
And you just, Kelly Jane, you just asked the question and sort of answered it why. I'll ask it again. There are lots of different, many hundreds, thousands of facets of immigration policy. This administration, both the president and his immigration advisors, including Stephen Miller, have been clear that they want to make this much harder to get asylum, much harder to come to this country, much harder to stay both legally and illegally. But members of the military, people serving overseas, why go there?
That's what a lot of people are asking, and veterans groups were really quite outraged. Now, the Department of Homeland Security is saying that they just want to keep their policies in line with the State Department's policies. They're saying this is just a clarification to make things consistent. But nobody's been worried about this at all. This is not something that came up. And so, yeah, the idea is, are they trying to inch a little further into making it that much more difficult to become a U.S. citizen?
Another major aspect of the president's immigration policy, of course, is the wall. And there was some major news this week. Several outlets reported that the president ordered aides to do whatever it takes to get that promised border wall built. That includes fast-tracking construction contracts, seizing private land, even blowing off environmental rules, all to get that wall built. And here's the political part. Before the 2020 election, it is a major promise of the president. You remember his rallies, build that wall. Now, several major news outlets, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, all reported that the president told subordinates, Reed, that he would pardon anyone who broke the law while executing his orders and getting that wall built. We're going to talk about that. What is the current state of the wall. This is a perennial debate. How much of it has been built? How much of the president's promise has he delivered to his base?
And he has not delivered much of the promise. During the campaign, he pledged that he'd have 500 miles of border wall built during his first term. They've only completed about 60 miles of vehicle barriers and replacing existing fencing.
Replacing existing fence and not new wall.
That's the very important part. And a big part of that is because of what the president was talking about. A lot of the land that is along the U.S.-Mexico border is privately held. And the president has talked about seizing that land through eminent domain. The White House said he was joking about the pardons, but, you know, he's joked about pardons before. And by the way, in saying that he was joking about the pardons, they're sort of confirming that he actually said that he would pardon people.
Wait a second. The president called it fake in a tweet. The Amazon, Washington Post, and CNN did a fake interview on pardons for aides on the wall. Is he joking or is it fake?
Well, the White House officials who talked to these outlets said that he was joking, which to me sounds like a pretty stark confirmation that he said it. Of course, what he says on his Twitter feed and what he says in private meetings are two different things. I would suggest, though, that this could turn into quite a political problem for the president, because if you've ever been to Texas, they don't like the idea of the government seizing their property through eminent domain. This is something that has come up in previous administrations. The Bush administration found sort of a hornet's nest around some of these issues back in Texas. And, you know, seizing land, that seems to trample on sort of the very notion of what it means to be a Texan, right? The government coming in and taking somebody's land. So I doubt this is going to happen in the end. But the suggestion alone that he could pardon people for taking illegal actions is not the first time he's made one of these. Back in April, when he ordered the acting head of the Department of Homeland Security to shut down the southwest border, he said again that he could pardon people if they took any illegal actions at his behest.
And Steve, what about this story? Reed is correct. It's not the first time the president is documented to have either dangled or promised pardons. There was the Secretary of Homeland Security. There are many, many reports dipping in and out of the Mueller report. The president's own tweets widely interpreted as dangling pardons in front of Paul Manafort if he stays true and stays strong. Michael Cohen said he had evidence of dangling pardons. The Democratic leadership in the House, the House is coming back next week, they've promised that this promising of pardons in return for prophylactic lawbreaking is a potential article of impeachment.
Yeah, I think politically, that's the interesting question. You mentioned it's Democrats coming back, and one of the things we've seen in the few weeks that the House coming back, one of the few weeks things that we've seen the last few weeks is the number of Democrats calling for an impeachment inquiry has grown. It's substantially more than half the Democratic caucus now in the House. There's a question now, I think one of the immediate questions that's going to be faced by Democrats is how serious is that? You know, is that something where members are trying to get on the record because that's sort of where the base of their party is, and at this point they feel there's nothing to be lost being there? Or is this something that's going to be a major concerted push starting in September? Because, you know, we've talked to Democrats about how they imagine a potential impeachment going. You sort of have two modern historical models. You have the Clinton one in 98. You have the Nixon one in the 70s. The Clinton one was kind of an express impeachment. It took about 2 months to get through from the House to the Senate. You know, the Nixon one ran about 10 months. And that's the model, when I've talked to Democrats, that's the model they've pointed to, sort of a Nixon-style impeachment. Well, if you're going to have a 10-month or so, you know, impeachment saga playing out, and this president's facing re-election next year, time, you know, is of the essence here. You've got to get that started right away. So it's interesting. I think that's something they're going to have to make a decision on pretty quickly.
And I want to point out how seamlessly we've just gone from a discussion of the president's political imperatives in 2020, ordering aides to get that wall built, to the very real discussion, Kelly, of impeachment in the House, how Democrats are managing it. We started off talking about building the wall. We ended on a very apt point from Steve Kornacki, is this just feeds right in to how Democrats manage impeachment, if at all?
Well, that's a great question, Todd. And I will have to say that also with the election ramping up, that might also be one reason we're seeing some movement on things like immigration and building the wall. Nobody can figure out why they have this new rule. Well, maybe Trump is trying to feed that base going into 2020. And part of it is that because he has not actually built the wall, he has built no new border wall, in fact, as my outlet has reported. But yes, Democrats are itching to impeach, but Nancy Pelosi is still pushing back on that. She is not interested, and I think it's because she realizes the public on the whole is not interested. And, you know, talking about the timeline, if this is going to go into the election, well, the American people will be able to make their decision then, I think, on whether Donald Trump will be president or not. And I think the Democrats really need something more than impeachment going into the election season. They need to show either that they've tried or that they've successfully put through some legislation that they can point to as accomplishments. I'm not sure how well they will be able to campaign on a single issue, impeaching Donald Trump.
There's this underlying tension. They had it in the midterm elections, and they have it now, of being the party, sorry to use a slogan, a party of ideas, healthcare, financial well-being, personal debt versus being simply anti-Trump. We got this tweet from Janie, who said, in regard to armed forces personnel unable to become American citizens, or at least their children, if you're willing to die for my country, you are the American citizen that I want. Coming up, who's in and who's out in that 2020 race that Kelly Jane just mentioned? Plus, how did President Trump do at the G7 summit? We have more with Reed Wilson of The Hill, Steve Kornacki of NBC News, and Kelly Jane Torrance of The Washington Examiner. They're all coming back next with me. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to be with you. It's the News Roundup from 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
If you love this show, then check out Life Kit, tools to help you get it together. Think of it as that friend who always has great advice on everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. Subscribe to Life Kit All Guides to get episodes on every topic all in one place. Find it in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup. My guests are Washington Examiner senior editor Kelly Jane Torrance, Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and Steve Kornacki, national political correspondent for MSNBC and NBC News. Reed Wilson, you mentioned in the break another important immigration story that we wanted to get to. The administration has rescinded deferred action for children from other countries in this country getting critical emergency medical assistance.
Not just children, for immigrants in this country who are getting treatment for illnesses. The Citizenship and Immigration Services say that they get about 1,000 of these applications for this program a year. These people are being treated for cancer, for rare diseases, rare genetic diseases, sickle cell anemia, things that, that American hospitals can treat them for that they will not get back in their home countries. Some of these, the people in this deferred action program have gotten letters. We didn't even know that this was a rule that was being propagated because there was no comment period or anything like that. The people who are receiving these treatments have gotten letters saying they have about a month to leave the country. And in a lot of cases, they worry that they will not be able to get treatment for these illnesses back home. This is effectively a death sentence for some people who will not be able to get these same treatments.
These are people in the middle of their medical treatment that they can't get back home. Mm-hmm. I give you the same question I gave Kelly Jane before the break. Why?
I don't know. This is the really troubling part about this is that Citizenship and Immigration Services, which handles this program, now says that these people will have to apply for this deferred action program through Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and ICE didn't apparently know that this change was coming. So if someone is rejected, there's no appeals process in order. There's no recourse that they can seek to potentially stay here and save their own lives.
Kelly Jane, you mentioned before the break that maybe these swipes at immigrants, especially immigrants in desperate situations, might be something that President Trump feels his base wants to see before an election. Does this qualify?
Well, you have to wonder why else would he be doing this? We have a limited amount of resources in this country. And as President Trump himself keeps saying, there's a humanitarian crisis at the border. So why use those resources to send out letters to children and adults and their family members here for medical treatment. Why go after this very small number of people that are going to be affected overseas? I have to think that part of it may be a political calculation. Trump's base wants to know that he is doing what they want him to do. And again, he can't point to that border wall yet. So he's going to do things like this to, you know, perhaps reassure them, this is what I care about. This is what's important, even though I've made some deals with Democrats on other things.
Duncan on Twitter echoes your point, Reid. This is effectively a death warrant for many of these children. And Rita in Cincinnati says, how is kicking out sick kids with fatal diseases, some of whom are paying pro-life? Why is no one asking that question? That's a story that we're going to be following in the coming days and weeks here on 1A. I want to move on to Hurricane Dorian making its way through the Caribbean, strengthening as it's moving toward Florida. Now, it missed Puerto Rico, which was good news for that island, still recovering from Hurricane Maria. That storm claimed just under 3,000 lives. But just as the threat of another natural disaster put Puerto Rico back in the headlines, thanks to an ongoing feud between the president and the Puerto Rican government and officials there. Steve Kornacki, can you explain the latest rift? We were all watching Puerto Rico because of Dorian, and the president took to Twitter and started throwing jabs once again at the government there.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the, in terms of the president's reaction and his sort of his bluster on this. This is the sequel to what you saw with Maria. The storm is approaching Puerto Rico. The president takes to Twitter, basically says, here we, you know, as always, a storm is on its way to Puerto Rico, and then takes shots specifically at the mayor of San Juan. And you remember that last year, the president had been going after her as well. She had been critical of the administration's handling of the hurricane. So what it underscored, I think, is just, and we've had this conversation countless times during the Trump presidency, but just how different he is than any past president, any modern past president, Democrat or Republican, because these are the kinds of moments of a national tragedy, of a looming natural disaster, anything of that sort. These are the moments when presidents in the past have risen above any kind of attack politics, any kind of partisan politics, and certainly have not engaged in the kind of sniping that you saw this president engage in. And I think it's directly related to the fact that the reality that if you just look at Donald Trump's approval rating as president, he's the only modern president who has never cracked 50%, which means at no point in his presidency has he gotten folks who are generally against him, maybe generally against his party. He's never gotten them to give him the benefit of the doubt at any point in his presidency. And I think this is an example of why.
We are at that moment as the country anticipates a horrible storm when cable news is tracking the storm moment by moment. People are worried about the storms. Unfortunately, they do make good television, but they also can wreak unbelievable havoc on communities along the coast of Florida. Appears, as I said, to be in the crosshairs now, Reid. Lots of preparations going on. What do we know about interactions between the state of Florida, FEMA, the federal government, the Trump administration to prepare Florida, the eastern coast of Florida for landfall?
So President Trump has canceled his trip to Poland this weekend. He's going to send Vice President Pence instead so that he can monitor the storm from back here. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp have already declared states of emergency. They've already asked the White House to sort of pre-clear counties to get the aid that they need, and this is more than just Florida that's in the crosshairs. The one of the latest tracks that we saw projects 1 to 2 feet of rain in every coastal county from Florida all the way up to North Carolina. So it's going to be pretty soaking wet down there. The storm is apparently moving much slower than other storms have in the past, and a slower moving storm means more rain that gets dumped on these areas. So this is the track shows that almost the entire state of Florida is in the path or the possible path of this thing. So it could hit and have some pretty devastating consequences.
A slower moving storm has more time to pick up water and moisture and energy from the ocean, where it can become even more dangerous. They're predicting a Category 4 storm now, and we all hope it doesn't go anything beyond that by the time it makes landfall. We're going to keep our eyes on the storm, of course, but I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time on politics. Steve, because we have you here. Reid, we have you here. Kelly Jane, of course, but we got some major political experts here. And there was some political news from the campaign trail, both Republican and Democratic this week. The field of candidates running for president in 2020, it started to shrink on that Democratic side. This week, it grew on the Republican side. It could grow more in the days and weeks ahead. But let's start with the Dems. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton dropped out at the end of last week. And then this week, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand out of the race. She failed to qualify for the next round of Democratic debates in September. Let's take a listen to the senator, what she said about why she's dropping out.
Hey, everyone. I wanted you to hear it from me first, that after more than 8 incredible months, I'm ending my presidential campaign. I know this isn't the result we wanted. We wanted to win this race. But it's important to know when it's not your time, and to know how you can best serve your community and country. I believe I can best serve by helping to unite us to beat Donald Trump in 2020.
Steve Kornacki, Kirsten Gillibrand was the first woman to get into the race. Now she's the first to get out. She has a real reputation in the Senate, I have to say, as an unwavering fighter for the causes that she believes in. So was it a surprise that she failed to catch on here?
Yeah, I think, look, by the end, it's not a surprise she's getting out of this because there had been no signs of momentum, you know, all along. I suspect one of the things that that hurt her. I think there's two things that might have hurt her in this. Number one is just the unprecedented size of this field. You know, 24 Democratic candidates. I think it was harder than ever. It's strange because you had more candidates than ever kind of look at the situation, size it up, and say, hey, you know, in the age of Trump, who's to say I can't run and I can't win the presidency? But I think the fact that so many stepped forward and ran made it hard for those who weren't immediately in the top tier to get heard and to make any kind of move. We haven't seen any traction outside really of I think Pete Buttigieg, any traction from the sort of the back of the pack to get close to the front during this campaign. So I think that hurt her. I think the other thing that hurt her too is just her evolution as a political figure over the decade or so that she's been in Congress and the Senate, the House and the Senate. We've seen this with other politicians, but it's particularly dramatic with her. She was a member of the House from upstate New York, elected originally in 2006, got reelected in 2008. She was pro-gun. She was a hardliner on immigration. It was a Republican district that she was elected in, and she really fit the profile of the kind of Democrat who could win there. And then, you know, when Hillary Clinton became Barack Obama's Secretary of State, left the Senate, Gillibrand kind of by surprise won an appointment to the U.S. Senate. And she immediately faced the prospects of, hey, I've got to appeal to a statewide New York Democratic Party electorate here. So she changed a bunch of positions. And I think she continued to move in that direction to the point that I think she was kind of staking her campaign potentially on the Democratic Party being farther to the left than maybe it actually is. So I think she was I'm not sure her positioning was quite in line with where the Democratic Party is. And I'm not sure folks who are where she thinks the Democratic Party is necessarily bought the authenticity of her conversion. Mm.
Now, Reid, one of the milestones that might have driven Kirsten Gillibrand from the race was the latest round of qualification for the next round of debate. I want to say it's hard to learn anything about anybody with two nights of debates, 10 per night, podiums as far as the eye can see, and 12 seconds to answer a question on issues that really require a huge amount of debate in this country. What do we know about the next round of debates, the winnowing here? And I'll lump it in with a question about the polls. Forget about individual polls, but what are the responses from voters telling us as the field winnows and Democrats head into the next round of debates?
So this latest deadline by which the candidates had to qualify for the September debates really marked a big turning point, a big inflection point in the race, if you will. We've mentioned Seth Moulton getting out and Kirsten Gillibrand, but also, you know, Governor Jay Inslee of Washington got out last week. And there are a few campaigns now that have not made the debate stage that tell us that they're going to soldier on and really focus on sort of what matters in winning over voters in a place like Iowa and New Hampshire. Montana Governor Steve Bullock, Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado, Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, John Delaney, the former congressman from Maryland. They all say that they're in this race for the long run, even though they won't be on the debate stage in early September 12th. I think it is the next debate is going to be held down in Houston with only 10 Democrats on stage. But then again, it's going to be a 3-hour event instead of two. So we're all going to be just 1 hour more exhausted in the long run. But they're going to have a little more time now to answer the questions. I think the initial questions will get a minute and 15 seconds to offer a more sort of complete and
thoughtful answer.
Wow,
a minute and 15. Imagine that.
And follow-ups will be 45 seconds. So it's going to be presumably no raising of hands hands and things like that that we'll see. The surveys, as Steve sort of alluded to, have been remarkably consistent over the last the first 8 months of the year, if you will. What we've seen is, you know, Elizabeth Warren rising into a solid second or tie for second place, Pete Buttigieg rising and then sort of settling in the long run, but everybody else is pretty much where they were at the beginning of this contest. It's a stable race. It's going to be up until we see a few more debates or at least some movement, some actual voter casting a ballot in a state like Iowa.
Now, you mentioned Iowa, and so many of the candidates spend so much time there. First in the nation, we know the score. But news out of Iowa last night from the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, read, rejecting Iowa's plan for virtual caucuses due to security of the process. This plan would have let caucus goers participate by phone. It is a very traditional but notoriously difficult process, especially for people with disabilities, heavy snow outside Des Moines, you name it. It's not an easy process to participate in. Iowa wanted to make it easier, but there are major implications here. Explain.
Yeah, I thought this could have led to a serious disaster if they were going to have these virtual caucuses. The caucus turnout in the largest caucus ever, the 2008 caucuses, was something around 225,000 people who showed up. The Iowa Democrats are so excited for this process this year and for the candidates who are running. And by the way, just having 20 candidates in the field is going to boost turnout no matter what, because half the candidates are going to live there by that point. The party was planning for an even larger increase in turnout. So 300, 400,000 people could show up. Now that's going to overwhelm a lot of these caucus locations, which are, you know, school cafeterias or gymnasia places, community centers, places like that. They're going to be lines out the door into that snow on an early February night in 2020. So the Iowa party wanted to create these virtual caucuses. People could call in and register their votes. They were going to allocate an extra number of delegates. All very confusing. And then at the end of the day, the state party was going to release a final number, the actual number of people who supported candidate X or candidate Y in both the in-person caucuses and the virtual caucuses. So what we could have seen was the virtual caucuses going to, hypothetically, you know, Bernie Sanders winning by 10,000 votes, but Elizabeth Warren winning the in-person caucuses. And because the in-person caucuses are valued higher, then they, you know, it would have been amazingly confusing. Everybody would have been able to claim that they had actually won. So the end of the virtual caucus might be a better thing for clarity in terms of who actually won, but it will keep a cap on the number of people who actually participate in those caucuses.
And the Democratic National Committee still smarting from a lack of clarity in the last major election. Major confrontations between Bernie Sanders and his supporters and establishment candidates like Hillary Rodham Clinton definitely on board to avoid confusion and lack of clarity. The Republican field, meanwhile, grew. Kelly Jane, I want to make sure I get to you on this because former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh, who's a radio guy now, an incendiary presence on Twitter and on your cable channels, has said he's challenging President Trump in the Republican Party. Who is Joe Walsh? What does he bring to the race? And what exactly is he up to?
So, all good questions, Todd. So as you mentioned, Joe Walsh, former Illinois congressman, now radio host, and like a lot of conservative talk radio hosts, he can be a little extreme, and he likes to use very touchy rhetoric.
Sometimes racist.
Exactly. Rhetoric. And this is one reason why a lot of Republicans who are not happy with President Trump are asking, why Joe Walsh? You've got a lot of people who are not happy with President Trump on the right. The one guy you decide to find, and I should say, of course, that Bill Weld, former Massachusetts governor, is also planning to challenge Donald Trump in the primary. But you look everywhere across the country and you find a guy who himself was a member of the birther conspiracy club about President Barack Obama, someone who himself has said that there are too many Muslims coming to the United States, that a Muslim travel ban was a good idea, someone who himself has criticized American cities in a, you know, what some take to be a racist way. He said things about Chicago and New York, for example. So he, of course, says, I'm sorry for those things. I'm a different person now. But, you know, if you're challenging President Trump because you think he is a bad person, if you think he's racist, if you think that he says hateful things, why pick someone who has said many of those things himself? It's a debate right now on the right, that's for sure.
Joe writes on Facebook, if you're going to vote for a primary challenger to Donald Trump, Joe Walsh is not a good choice. Take a look at Bill Weld, who Kelly Jane just mentioned. Just ahead, Newark, New Jersey. Is it the next Flint, Michigan? We're going to talk about former FBI Director James Comey and a scathing report from the Department of Justice. And we're going to talk a little bit about the new Barbie. That's right, the new Barbie. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, knows that building trust is essential to forging strong relationships with her Home Instead clients.
I seen the ad in the paper and I called, and 3 days after I was hired, I was with my very first client. You've got to have patience in order to be a good caregiver. You've got to build up the trust. I just love it. I couldn't ask for a better job or a better client.
To learn more or to search for available senior care job opportunities with Home Instead Senior Care, visit homeinstead.com.
This is Elise Spiegel from Invisibilia, and guess what? We just launched a fall season where we're trying new things. Monthly stories that are a little bit shorter, feature new voices and new kinds of storytelling and sound. Our first fall story is about a man and the thing that he loves most, which is a giant plastic elephant. You should definitely tune in.
It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. Gang, before the break, I mentioned former FBI Director James Comey and that he was at the center of a Justice Department investigation this week. On Thursday, DOJ's Office of Inspector General released a long-awaited report. It was all about Comey's decision to keep some memos that he produced as FBI Director. Now, Comey, famously, met with President Trump several times as Comey neared what would turn out to be the end of the line for his job as FBI director. He was disturbed by what the president said to him, so he wrote it all down in memos. But then Comey gave some of those memos to a friend, and the friend gave some of those memos to the New York Times. You'll remember, this is memorializing the conversation where the president asked the FBI director to back off investigating National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who has since pled guilty to a felony. Steve Kornacki, what's the bottom line of this report? It appears, or at least it's claimed, it's concluded in the DOJ Inspector General report that indeed the former FBI director did break the rules.
Right. It's sort of a two-part thing there. The report is very harsh when it comes to the decisions that James Comey made in terms of getting that memo to a reporter, making a decision for himself. That he believed it was important for the information to be out there, so therefore it was the correct thing to do. So it was very harsh on his judgment, on his decision making. But the DOJ also took the report and declined to prosecute, said, you know, there were actually no laws that were broken here. So this was castigating him for poor judgment, but saying there wouldn't be a prosecution. There's an irony there, of course, because James Comey, we all remember from July 2016, holding that press conference and announcing that, hey, there weren't going to be any charges against Hillary Clinton for her, the email situation, but then essentially castigating her for all sorts of terrible decision making and essentially indicting her in the court of public opinion. So now what he did in the case of Hillary Clinton is in a way being done to him through this Inspector General report. But basically, there's an argument here that he's trying to put out there, that his defenders are putting out there, that what do you do in a situation like that? If you believe the president has approached you and said all sorts of unacceptable, potentially illegal things, you have the records of them, the president fires you, how do you bring this out? He said his version of it is, this is what he had to do. He had to get a story into the newspapers. He had to get the memos out there, had to get a special counsel appointed. It was in the best interest of the country. And that's the defense he offers.
Kelly Jane, the president has, the DOJ did conclude that James Comey broke FBI rules and protocols. The president has tweeted, I don't know how many times, somebody had it on Twitter with a count. I want to say it's 7 or 8 or 9 times that James Comey had trafficked and released and leaked classified information. DOJ says that's not true.
That's right. The DOJ did say that he released information he wasn't supposed to, but none of that was classified. They did mention, though, that despite knowing that at least one of the memos contained classified information, he didn't mark it at all and, you know, kept it in a safe. I mean, you know, you have to ask who has the biggest ego in Washington. I think most of us think it's President Trump. Sometimes I think it could be James Comey. This is a guy who really thinks that he knows better than other people. And these memos were government property, and he knew that, and he treated them like they were personal property. It's funny, he tweeted afterwards asking for an apology from people. And yes, there were some inaccurate statements made, many of them by Donald Trump, about him leaking classified info. But this report, as Steve said, certainly does not, you know, vindicate him at all. And again, yeah, this is the second Inspector General report that's criticized Comey after one that the Inspector General did on the how Comey handled the Clinton email investigation, as Steve also mentioned. You know, I do have to say, though, you know, Donald Trump said this week a couple times on Twitter, I think, that this makes James Comey the most disgraced person in American history. Well, I would say, you know, Aaron Burr perhaps would be more of a contender for that title.
Most disgraced in American history.
Exactly. Neither of these guys is really, you know, who can talk, right? But yeah, it's quite interesting. And I think, you know, people have talked about, is James Comey interested in a political career? This is yet another thing that speaks to the difficulty he'll have in the future, if that's what he has in mind.
We got this from Toby in Louisville, Kentucky, who says he violated FBI DOJ policy. Give me a break. Where do the FBI and the DOJ have a written policy to deal with a president, their boss, breaking the law? Comey had to improvise in dealing with a mafioso-styled don, President Trump, who tried to enforce personal loyalty to himself over fealty to the United States Constitution. Comey chose the latter. That's Toby's view from Kentucky. The DOJ IG took a different view. I want to get us outside of the Beltway. There's an extremely important story coming out in Oklahoma and in every state and thousands of communities all over this country. Big news in the search for accountability in the opioid crisis. On Monday, a judge in Oklahoma ordered Johnson & Johnson, pharmaceutical giant, to pay $572 million after the judge ruled that the company had intentionally misled the public about the benefits and dangers of opioid pain medications. Now, this ruling came after two other opioid manufacturers, Purdue Pharma and Teva Pharmaceuticals, agreed to pay the state tens of millions of dollars each in settlements. Johnson & Johnson had refused to settle, so they went to the judge. Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter spoke after the ruling came down.
Today, Judge Bachman has affirmed our position that Johnson & Johnson, motivated by greed and avarice, is responsible for the opioid epidemic in our state. Johnson & Johnson will finally be held accountable for thousands of deaths and addiction caused by their activities.
Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter there on Monday. Just the next day, multiple outlets reported that Purdue Pharma, which I just mentioned, and its owner, the Sackler family, is nearing a deal to settle out of court 2,000 lawsuits against the company, separate from that case in Oklahoma. That company could go bankrupt as a result of the deal, potentially billions of dollars transferred from the family. Reed, how big, if at all, a turning point, this Oklahoma decision and the potential settlement with the Sackler family are we looking at here?
We're getting very close to a tipping point moment in the opioid crisis, and when some of these companies that have pumped literally hundreds of millions of pills into communities around the country. The Oklahoma case is interesting because the attorney general didn't go after the company under fraud statutes or sort of the normal things that you would think a company might be sued over. He sued them under a public nuisance law. And the public nuisance is, you know, that's like polluting a river or being too loud or something like that. And the public nuisance is something that basically he alleged that the company had created this public nuisance through their deceptive marketing practices of marketing these opioid drugs. J&J doesn't like the strategy that they've obviously now just lost under, but this could be a path for some other states that are trying to reclaim some money money from some of these companies. The Purdue Pharma settlement is interesting, but there's a lot longer to go in this process. Purdue is negotiating with about 10 states, and I think it's 48 states that have sued. So there are 38 states that are still on the sidelines. As you mentioned, there are thousands of cities and counties across the country that have launched their own lawsuits. It's not yet clear if all of these suits plaintiffs would join the settlement if one is actually reached. But what it would do is it would basically transform this private company, Purdue Pharma, into a public beneficiary trust, which means that the profits from all the drugs that they sell would eventually go to the states and cities that are trying to combat the opioid epidemic. And the addiction treatment drugs that would be used to get people off of opioids would be given to the public for free.
So, and that's a huge difference, because for Johnson & Johnson, $527 million, if that's the number I quoted, is really a cost of doing business. Let's be honest. They've made billions and billions on these drugs and others. For Purdue Pharma, Kelly Jane, this is potentially a bankrupting deal that would make them almost in some ways a beneficiary of the many, many people that they've helped to addict.
Exactly. You know, this deal, the Purdue deal, it's estimated to be worth about $12 billion, and $3 billion of that would be in cash from the Sackler family. This could be a lot of money. I was trying to figure out how much they're worth, and some estimates were only $3.5 billion. So this could be a lot of their own money. And yeah, bankruptcy. But what's interesting, though, is part of this deal that they're working on would be tied to future sales of OxyContin, one of the opioids that is one of the most problematic that a lot of people have become addicted to. So that $12 billion would rely in part on sales of this opioid that people are getting addicted to. So it's a very problematic settlement, I think. You know, the other thing that occurs to me is, of course, we're going after the big companies because they have a lot of money. But is that going to solve the crisis? You have to look at how did people get these pills. And of course, you had a lot of doctors who were very willing to prescribe when maybe they weren't necessary, and to prescribe perhaps more than were necessary. So this may help with some of the public health problems if these settlements finally come. But is it going to help keep people from becoming addicted? I think that's another question.
I point people toward the Washington Post's ongoing reporting about the opioid crisis, tracking the path of pills from pharmaceutical manufacturers through distributors to pharmacies to communities where tens, hundreds of thousands, millions of pills are pouring into communities with just a couple of thousand people, and letting the money pour in while the addiction and the tragedy pours out. I point you to the Washington Post, who's been doing an incredible job documenting this crisis. Steve Kornacki, you know, communities, there's hardly a community untouched by the opioid crisis. And it's even worse in places like Ohio, places like Colorado, across the West, places that political reporters like you look at in terms of votes. But I wonder if candidates who are stumping for votes in these places have talked to communities in a meaningful way about the devastation that's hit their towns.
You know, it's interesting. The story is set here in Oklahoma. We think of politically, we think of Oklahoma as a deeply red state, deeply Republican state, kind of Republican across the board in terms of its office holders. And yet, politically, you can connect what Republicans in Oklahoma are saying, for instance, I heard Joe Biden on the campaign trail just a couple weeks ago talking about putting some of these executives in jail. Potentially, this is something that unites both parties. It reminds me a bit, too, of I'm thinking back to the tobacco settlements, you know, the
right.
1990s. And it was sort of a moment where after years, after decades of sort of mounting evidence, mounting research, mounting stories of personal health tragedies, there became a political will to take on these companies. And of course, that played out over years, obviously, but did ultimately result in those settlements. Although what you're describing, there's the difference between the settlement that is the cost of doing business and the settlement that actually changes and potentially puts out of business a company. And I think those tobacco settlements fell into the first category.
And transforms an industry and changes its relationship with the public that it helped to poison, frankly. Before we go for the hour here, I want to make sure that we touch on one other important story underreported in the news. Picture local government officials at the front of long lines handing out water bottles and water filters because of high levels of lead in the drinking water. Now, you might say, yeah, that's Flint, Michigan. But this past week, no, it wasn't. This was Newark, New Jersey. Kelly Jane, can you give us a little bit of an update? What's been going on in Newark, New Jersey? There is lead in the water, and people, again, for another time, are wondering, how can this happen?
Exactly, Todd. It's amazing to me. So they discovered that, you know, lead was leaching out of pipes into water in Newark. So they handed out to people the same water filters that were handed out in Flint, Michigan in 2014. Have you think that after 5 years, people would have learned what to do, what not to do, at least? But no, they did it. And of course, those filters proved to be completely, well, not completely, but very much useless. Lead was still getting through. So then they started having to hand out water bottles. And you had people standing in line for hours in the heat waiting for some water. It's really crazy. So, you know, the city is going to have to borrow, I think, $120 million to replace those pipes more quickly. And it's a real crisis. And again, what is local government doing? This, you know, keeping people safe, attending to the most basic things like a city's water supply, that has to be the priority of the local government. And 5 years after Flint, Michigan, we're seeing a repeat of that in a, you know, pretty big city in America.
Lead is highly toxic to children. It definitely impacts their long-term mental capabilities, their mental acuity, and their ability to be productive adults. This is a major scandal in Newark, and I'm glad that we brought it to the attention of our listening public if they haven't read about it. Well, it's time to go, and before we do like to leave on somewhat of a brighter note, if we can, as we head into the holiday weekend, and I'm happy to report to you that this year marks the 60th anniversary of the debut of Barbie. And this week, the iconic doll added to her history with a tribute to a pair of powerful women. Monday was Women's Equality Day, and Mattel, who makes Barbie, of course, released dolls honoring civil rights activist Rosa Parks and Sally Ride, who was the first American woman in space, aboard the space shuttle. They're part of the Inspiring Women series. It also includes artists like Frida Kahlo, pilot Amelia Earhart, and if you're planning to add to your collection, grab one better than old Malibu Barbie skirting around L.A. with Ken and her. What did she drive? What did Malibu Barbie drive?
The dream van.
The dream van. There it is. Well, what do you think of the new Barbie? Let us know here at 1A. I want to thank all of my guests, Steve Kornacki, national political correspondent for MSNBC and NBC. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Kelly Jane Torrance, senior editor for the Washington Examiner. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
And Reed Wilson with The Hill. Thanks, Reed.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical assistance from Ben Privett and Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy, Catherine Fink, and Christopher Castano. We'll dive into the international section of the news roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please do take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find this show too. Thanks.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is the Friday News Roundup. Britain's new prime minister, Boris Johnson, put the hammer down to quash opposition to a no-deal Brexit. Italy has managed to thwart a turn to the far right for now, but upcoming German elections are expected to fuel the rise of right-wing parties. Forest fires in the Amazon are at the center of a geopolitical feud, and whiplash is a word a number of news organizations use to describe President Trump's performance at the G7 summit in Europe. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. With me in the studio, Ron Nixon, international investigations editor for the Associated Press. Ron is author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Great to have you back, Ron.
Thank you.
Jennifer Williams is here, senior foreign editor for Vox.com. Politico.com and co-host of Vox's Foreign Affairs podcast, Worldly. Great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Simon Marks is here. Simon is president and chief correspondent for Feature Story News. Simon, as always, great to see you.
Great seeing you, Todd.
Well, let's start in the UK. Wednesday's decision by Her Majesty the Queen, Elizabeth II herself, to approve Prime Minister Boris Johnson's request to suspend Parliament until the middle of October. Now, a lot of people saw this as Boris Johnson's way to prevent his adversaries from blocking a no-deal Brexit before the October 31st deadline. And some people went a lot further than that.
Shutting down Parliament in order to force through a no-deal Brexit, which will do untold and lasting damage to the country, is not democracy, it's dictatorship. And if MPs don't come together next week to stop Boris Johnson in his tracks, then I think today will go down in history as the day UK democracy died.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon there. Simon, my British friend, so often we ask this of your countrymen when they come on this show, what is going on? We always have the same refrain when it comes to Brexit. What's the latest here? What is the significance of what Nicola Sturgeon calls the end of democracy on the island?
I was thinking on the way here, Todd, that we could spend the entire hour discussing British parliamentary procedure or the vagaries of operating with an unwritten constitution, but it might just be easier to explain the rules of cricket to everybody. I mean, I think we'd get further and understand more. Look, this is a huge move by Boris Johnson, fueled by 17.2 million voters who in that referendum 3 years ago now said they wanted to pull Britain out of the European Union. He is essentially risking a constitutional crisis and I think even a societal crisis to try and get Britain out of the European Union. But the problem is that he is a prime minister himself with no democratic mandate of his own. He replaced Theresa May as a result of the votes of members of the British Conservative Party, less than 0.1% of the British public essentially voted him in. He has inherited exactly the same parliamentary array of forces and parliamentary difficulties that tied Theresa May up in knots. We sit here and we see, you know, that shock of blonde hair and we think, oh, everything's changed in the UK. Nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is the occupant of number 10 Downing Street. And he's doing the one thing that five members of his own cabinet argued less than a month ago would be profoundly undemocratic and autocratic, namely an end run around Parliament. He's going to prorogue it, which is a fancy name for saying suspend its activities for several days. I mean, the number of days involved is open to debate, but for 5 weeks, Parliament will not meet in what he hopes is a move that will allow him to pave the way, if necessary, to pull Britain out of the European Union without an agreement with Brussels, something that he knows Parliament would vote to block. And there's a fundamental issue here, which is sovereignty. Supporters of Brexit have argued, since the debate was first mooted, that one of the reasons why Britain needs to leave the European Union is because we need to get our sovereignty back. But Britain's sovereignty is enshrined in what we are all taught at grade school is the mother of parliaments. So the idea that in order to get British sovereignty back, you actually may have to suspend the activities of Parliament is a real rhetorical problem for Boris Johnson. And he's going to be facing, I think, major protests over the next few days as a result of that.
I cannot tell you what Hugh Grant, famous British actor, tweeted about this because it would get us fined by the FCC and get me thrown off the air. But Ron Howard, rank and file people reacting. Is this similar to what happens in the United States where there's sort of outrage on one side, shrugs on another side, and people sort of move on to the next outrage? Or is this really permeating British society?
Yeah, I think this is permeating British society because while obviously, Labour is opposed to this, but you also have the Tories, conservatives, who are opposed to this too. And you just saw that, you know, former British Prime Minister John Major has jumped in on a lawsuit to try and stop this activity. I mean, it seems that Johnson is betting that the EU would somehow be brought to the table to discuss, you know, a better exit for Britain, but he doesn't have the power, he doesn't have the leverage to do that because there's nothing that he can offer the EU to do that. And that's what makes this so crazy. It's like, what's the point here other than trying to really force the EU to the table when you have a weak hand?
Well, let's talk about the EU coming to the table. Boris Johnson at home has a coalition, right, with no majority as one MP.
Wafer thin.
Right. Pointed at one MP I saw pointed out in the papers over the last couple of days. EU leaders, Ron, you're right, will meet to discuss a possible Brexit deal with the UK over dinner in Brussels on October 17th. Now, that's a reminder that Boris Johnson has said that October 31st is do or die.
Right.
It's going to happen, he says. Here he is defending his decision to suspend Parliament until the middle of October.
There will be ample time on both sides of that crucial October the 17th summit, ample time in Parliament for MPs to debate the EU, to debate Brexit, and all the other issues. Ample time.
Simon, Mary writes on Facebook, I heard a woman in rural England say that she was fully supportive of Boris Johnson, despite the fact that her business is already suffering under the threat of Brexit and will likely go under. Why?
Well, 17.2 million people voted in that referendum 3 years ago that David Cameron foolishly called. I think if he had his time over again, he would never have called it as Prime Minister. And they voted to leave the European Union. And 3 years on, Britain is still in the European Union. Boris Johnson is a man who comes along and says, I'm going to get us out, come hell or high water, by October the 31st. And all we need as a country is to harness the old Churchillian spirit, the stiff upper lip, a dose of optimism. And even though
no more doom and gloom,
though every government forecast suggests that if we leave the European without a deal, the British economy will shrink by 9% over the next 15 years. There are voters out there who say, if we stay in the European Union, that will be thwarting democracy. This is all about different competing views of what democracy in Britain today actually means.
Jenny, there were a few Tory officials did resign behind this. I don't want to say it's a lot. Did the Queen have to grant this request? Is that just sort of rote? Was there any way to block this? And is Simon correct that some people in the British countryside are perfectly happy to vote against their own interests here?
Absolutely. So on the question of the Queen, that has kind of brought this other debate kind of back into British politics, which is, what is the role of the Queen? What is the role of the monarchy in, you know, contemporary British politics? It was essentially a formality that Boris Johnson had to go to the Queen and say, you know, I'm going to do this proroguing of Parliament. And everyone expected that she would grant it because of the longstanding democratic, one would argue, tradition of the Queen staying out of, you know, the constitutional monarchy that is the modern UK. The problem is that, you know, people, because of this stunningly what most people see as anti-democratic move by Boris Johnson, people were pulling for this other anti kind of democratic move. Well, God, can somebody, you know, can, instead of God save the Queen, can the Queen save us? You know, can she please come in and do something? And the fact that she didn't, people were like, oh no, well, what are we going to do? So I think Simon's point on the competing kind of ideas of democracy, is perfectly spot on. You also have, you know, these people that we're talking about who did vote for Brexit. One of the arguments, and essentially the argument that Boris is making for this, is that, look, this was a democratic vote, right? This was a referendum. These people voted. It is therefore our democratic duty to carry out the will of the voters and to deliver this Brexit, right? That has been the kind of argument for following through on Brexit, regardless. That's what Theresa May argued. You know, she was not a super strong, you know, leaving the EU. She was a Remainer, but said, look, I will deliver this, what the voters said. And so Boris's argument here is that, well, if I have to, you know, suspend democracy for a few minutes to deliver democracy, that's fine. And, you know, on the other hand, people are going, well, what if we kind of suspended democracy and brought the Queen in to do this? So it's just kind of chaos on all sides. Meanwhile, British democracy is just kind of slowly crumbling on the sides.
Simon.
But there's a huge hostage to fortune here. If Boris Johnson as Prime Minister can suspend Parliament, even for a few days, in order to jam some kind of Brexit through, what stops any other Prime Minister further down the line from saying, oh, well, I don't think I can get one of my unpopular policies through Parliament. I think I'll do what Boris Johnson did, and I'll suspend it for a few days in order to jam it through. We are not, as a country, an autocratic nation. There is a Parliament that is supposedly sovereign and has a role to play here. This also, by the way, sends, I think, a really dangerous message globally. and particularly to a government that sits not that many miles away from where we're sitting right now, that if Boris Johnson can suspend Parliament in order to get some things done, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Even though there are constitutional niceties involved here, maybe other countries can do the same thing with their legislatures.
Jenny, is Simon saying that Britain is having an existential debate about democratic norms? Sounds familiar.
Imagine that. Yeah, and you know, just quickly, there was a BuzzFeed article recently talking about other ideas Boris Johnson had maybe floated, like even ignoring, even if there were legislation passed saying that you can't pull out by October 31st, saying, well, would it be legal if I just didn't do that? Hmm. So even worse democratic kind of norms slipping away.
Let me move us across the channel into continental Europe for a moment, Jennifer, because there was major news out of Italy. Look, we've been watching the rise in the circulation of far-right parties in countries all across Europe for the last couple of years. 1 week after he resigned, Giuseppe Conte has returned as prime minister in Italy. He's backing a new government, only this time without the hardline leader Matteo Salvini. Italy's president reappointed Conte to that role on Thursday. We might be used to a lot of political shuffling in Italy and a lot of governments. That's not new, but there seems to be something fundamentally important in this latest naming of the prime minister.
Right. So basically what we're dealing with is this essential power grab that Matteo Salvini tried to orchestrate sort of behind the scenes. So Salvini is the head of the far-right Lega Party. It basically started out as a kind of a regional party in the north, representing the interests of kind of the northern regions of Italy. Then Matteo Salvini takes over. He essentially moves it farther to the right, takes on a very populist kind of anti-immigrant tone. He gets very popular. But in the last election, he doesn't get enough to basically, you know, win outright and become prime minister. So he forms this coalition government with this five-star movement, which is kind of a bizarre kind of catch-all party that doesn't really stand for much except for being anti-establishment. So they form this coalition. Well, five-star movement isn't as popular as maybe Matteo Salvini would have liked. And he says, look, I'm going to cut the dead weight. I'm going to basically break up the government. And I'm going to try to see if I can force new elections, because that's what Italy definitely needs, is more elections, because they haven't had enough recently. So he basically makes this power grab to say, like, look, I'm going to bring down the government. That Giuseppe Conte resigns basically over this kind of brouhaha, kind of preempts this idea of him bringing down the government, no confidence vote. So you have this kind of situation where Salvini is hoping, okay, I'm going to get some elections. I bet I can do really well. I'll become prime minister. This is going to be great. Except it all went spectacularly wrongly and backfired on him. Because essentially what happened is his rivals, the center-left Democratic Party, basically made a coalition government. They said, okay, well, instead of having elections, we'll try to build a new government, right? And they do, with the five-star movement that Salvini just cut loose.
That was so weak in the first place.
Exactly. So now they have this center-left coalition government coming into power, and Matteo Salvini now finds himself completely out of power. So his power grab spectacularly backfired, and now he's not even in power, and he brought a center-left government into power. It's a wild turn of events for someone who has been this darling of the far right, who was seen as this rising star, and essentially played the wrong hand.
And it's got us keeping on our eye on far-right politics in the governments of our Western European allies. And I bring you to Germany, Simon, where regional elections are due to be held next week. Polls suggest that the far-right AfD will do well in those elections. Angela Merkel, like any leader as chancellor, is not going to last forever. She's already signaled the beginning of the end of her leadership of Germany. What is the state of the far right in Germany, and what is the state of that relationship with allies, including the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to get a sense of that after these two state elections in eastern Germany. I mean, the interesting thing about Angela Merkel, parenthetically, is that at the G7 summit in Biarritz at one point last weekend, she actually had to say, I'm still here, when it was mentioned that she would soon be departing the scene. You know, look, the east of Germany is a natural hotbed for extreme political parties to build support. This is a part of the country that was heavily industrialized, of course, during the Soviet era. The Berlin Wall comes down. East and West Germany are reunified. And suddenly all of those industries in the east that had been state supported and operating within a command economy now find themselves subject to market forces, and they close down and they have not been in large measure replaced. And so you see the AfD, the Alternative for Germany far-right party, poised to make great gains in Saxony, particularly in its sort of rural eastern fringes. This is a part of the country where an anti-immigration group, Pegida, grew and flourished previously. It's a part of the country that saw anti-foreigner riots last summer after an immigrant killed a Syrian asylum seeker, killed a German citizen. So it's soft ground in which these far-right movements can make gains. We will have to see just how substantial those gains are when the votes are counted. And it will help form the bigger question, which Jennifer was getting at, which is to what extent are these far-right populist movements now reaching the end of their natural life in countries like Italy and Austria, where we also saw a government collapse? Or have they still got legs in them? Is the Steve Bannon dream of extremism within Europe still in some sense alive?
I agree. And to the extent that Steve Bannon has been touring, or at least in previous years was touring Europe in pursuit of some kind of right-wing international, right, both in the United States and in Europe, to break up alliances and see a resurgence of the right wing, these next elections, both in the United States and in Europe, will tell us a lot about the longevity of his project. Well, every country, every leader, Angela Merkel, Salvini, anyone at the G7 summit has political concerns back at home as they stand on the world stage. And President Trump is no different. He's back from the G7, but he just announced that his upcoming trip to Poland to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the start of World War II, hereby canceled, at least for the president himself. He's not going. The president said he was canceling his visit so that he could monitor Hurricane Dorian, now headed toward the Florida coast, the eastern coast of the United States. He's sending Vice President Pence, Ron Nixon. The vice president's going instead of the president. Is there any reason to doubt the explanation that the president gave that he needs to stay home in order to monitor the hurricane?
I don't think there's a reason to doubt it. I mean, I think that in the past, presidents have done that when you've had a potential natural disaster occurring. So this fits with previous precedents for what presidents do, and send a vice president in his stead.
Now, the president had a lot more work to do this past week in Biarritz. Simon, you mentioned it, at the G7 summit. There were a lot of news flashes, some by tweet, some by generated by some of our allies, or maybe their political operatives. A big one, Trump working behind the scenes, apparently, in private conversations to make the G7 G8 again. That's what I like to call it. Get Russia back in the fold.
Trying to get Russia back into the G7, therefore making it G8, which was rejected by UK, Germany, and Canada, because they still feel that President Putin has not done anything about this situation with Ukraine. And that's their preconditions for readmitting Russia into the G7. But the president has been pushing this for quite some time. It's you know, we all know he is quite fond of President Putin. But even beyond that, he, you know, attacked former President Obama. He talked about maybe having the G7 at one of his properties in the U.S. You know, he both praised and attacked China. You know, it was all over the place. And I think, you know, Macron, being the host, tried to get something accomplished out of this meeting by having all these leaders here, by trying to bring in the Iranians and hoping that, well, if I have them face to face, maybe I can sort of revive this nuclear deal that all the countries had.
And talk about Macron's motive there, because the competing strategies, competing priorities completely, from the Trump administration now replacing sanctions on Iran, suspending the nuclear deal, the European allies are still in and doing business in exchange.
Right, because they thought it was effective. And they would like to revive this deal. And so Macron's attitude was that he knows that Trump likes to do a lot of things face to face. And so by bringing in, you know, representatives from the Iranian government and having them there, with the president being able to, but that was rejected because, again, we've taken the stance against Iran, and there doesn't appear to be any chance to back out of that with the administration. I will say one of the things that was kind of I wouldn't use the word disturbing, but kind of odd out of this, in that the leaders of these seven huge economies were trying to address the fires, which I know we'll get to later, in the Amazon, and they committed $20 million. These are the biggest economies in the world.
$20 million is nothing.
It probably cost that to do the G7 there.
Right. A very small amount of money. Yeah. And we are going to talk more about the fires on their impact and how Brazil is managing those fires and what the international community is trying to do. But what about fundamentals? Jennifer, there's a lot of, I have to say, there were plenty of superficial stories, tweets, and the rest of it that we could have reported on from the G7. What about the fundamentals? What did we take away from this meeting about the fundamental relationship between the United States and its key allies? I asked the question earlier this week whether our European partners are maybe sort of in a holding pattern to see who's president next, or whether the quality and the distance of the relationship is fundamentally changing.
So I think the fundamental thing to take away from the G7 is that Trump continues to be a wrecking ball on the international stage, right? Even before the G7 took place, Macron basically scrapped the entire idea of doing this communique, which is essentially the entire point of the G7, is to get all these countries. It's a club, right? The entire idea of does Russia deserve back in or not is kind of a political argument. It's not really an economic argument. If you wanted to get together, you know, other economies that are large, you would bring in India way before you would bring in Russia, right? There are plenty of countries that are way more powerful economically that you would want to bring to the club. That's not the point. The G7 is a club of like-minded countries who essentially try to get together and find common ground on things like climate change, on trade, on all sorts of international issues. The problem is that you cannot do that when you have someone like Donald Trump in the White House. And you can see that, you know, regardless of any of the other issues they tried to do, the entire purpose of this was managing Trump, right? Bringing in the Iranians to try to, once again, manage Donald Trump and to figure out what to do in that situation. You know, scrapping the communique because they knew Trump was not going to sign on. That's what happened last time around. He refused to sign on to this communique because it had things in there about climate change that he doesn't agree with. So I think you just see the true rift that is happening, that no longer is the U.S. like leading these conversations and a serious party at the table. It's like the toddler in the room that everyone has to babysit all week, and you can't get anything done when you're babysitting a toddler, as any parent knows.
Now, in the aftermath of the G7 summit, Simon, we had President Trump looking at blocking $250 million in military aid to Ukraine. Now, the United States and the Trump administration have said they're looking to make cuts in foreign aid and foreign investments anyway. On the one hand, you say, fine, policy decision. On the other hand, this comes just days after the president, as I said, is behind the scenes advocating for Russia's return to the G7 to make it G8 again. And blocking military aid to Ukraine is a primary policy goal of Vladimir Putin.
Absolutely. And Donald Trump not just campaigning to get Russia back into the G7 and turn it back into the G8 behind the scenes, doing it publicly in a truly shameless way. I mean, we shouldn't gloss over the fact that in front of other world leaders and the media, Donald Trump at this G7 summit totally misstated once again the reasons for Russia's expulsion from the group, suggesting that President Obama got outsmarted and it was somehow President Obama's fault that Crimea got invaded and annexed and occupied by the Russians while he was president of the United States. Those comments restate totally what actually happened when Russia was thrown out of the group. Then you come back to the United States and you discover that he is holding up this $250 million in military aid that is supposed to be going to Ukraine in order to confront in large measure Russia and its aggressive posture towards its neighbor. And you just sit there once again and you say, this is a president of the United States who, for reasons unexplained, is very oddly beguiled by President Vladimir Putin and does things all the time that are exactly what the Kremlin would like him to do. At some point, that's going to have to be explained, whether it's during his presidency or thereafter.
Before the president came home from G7, at the end of the summit on Monday, he spoke with reporters and he told him that Chinese officials had reached out to his administration over the weekend to try to restart trade talks. Now, this seemed to calm the markets a little bit, at least for a few hours or a day or two. The markets have been buffeted and uncertain because of trade confrontations and dueling tariffs between the United States and China. Here's what the president had to say.
I've gotten two calls and very, very good calls, very productive calls. They mean business. They want to be able to make a deal. They've lost 3 million jobs and a lot of things have happened. And it's why President Xi's a great leader. He understands, and it's going to be great for China. It's going to be great for the U.S. It's going to be great for the world. He understands that, and he's able to do things that other people aren't able to do. But I think we're going to make a deal because they don't want to lose their chains. They have supply chains that are unbelievably intricate, and people are all leaving. And they're going to other countries, including the United States, by the way. We're going to get a lot of them, too.
Ron, the markets had tanked before the president made this statement, and the statement seemed to smooth things a little bit on Wall Street. So it makes some sense. However, I have to ask you whether there was any evidence that these calls actually took
except
place.
Except that is the thing that the Chinese said those calls never took place. The president has done this in the past, saying he's received calls from people in a number of different settings. And so the staff was then, as they have done on a number of policy issues, they've had to walk that back and say, well, you know, what he actually meant was this, and that you guys in the media are just taking him literally. But that's what he said. And so how else do you take someone when they say that they've received a call? You know, that means to me that you've received these calls and there were discussions, but apparently they weren't.
And yet, if it was the president's aim to, you know, he hates a bad market. We all know that. He talks about stock markets all the time. Right. And if his aim was to reassure and smooth the markets, it may have worked. The market seems to have stabilized since the statement. I can't give you a cause and effect relationship, but.
But I think that that's just a market, a market correction, and just people started just understanding that this is a president and this is how he operates and these are the things that he says, and that you can't really, in some ways, you basically have to ignore him.
In terms of the United States' relationship with the rest of the world, Evan in McLean, Virginia writes, in regard to isolationism and protectionism, it's wise to remember the words of Winston Churchill. He said, the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without them. We mentioned the G7's pledge of $20 million to fight fires in the Amazon. Luisa Franco is a reporter with BBC News in Brazil. She joins me now from a landline in Sao Paulo as we cover the burning fires across Brazil in the Amazon rainforest. Luisa, do we have you?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. I can hear you. Okay.
Hi. Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you linking up from Brazil. You've been covering the fires that we've already talked about here on the news roundup this afternoon, all around the Brazil. Give us the latest on the current picture. How contained is this situation? Is it contained at all?
So data from Brazil's National Space Agency shows that the fires are still burning in the Amazon, and Brazilian firefighters are trying to put out the fires, but that's not super easy to do because some of these places are deep in the forest and sometimes hard to reach. To some extent, fires are to be expected at this time of year. It's part of traditional agricultural practice here in Brazil to burn the ground to renew pasture. And that's legal if it's done in a controlled manner and with environmental agencies' authorization. But what's causing concern now is that the number of fires has increased by around 80% this year compared to the same period last year. And that, of course, raised alarms here at a time when Brazil is run by a president who said that, you know, ever since before he was elected, that he intended to favor economic development over conservation. The fire, sorry.
Yes, I mean, some of the reporting has suggested that the increase in fires is due to a gloves-off policy from Bolsonaro's government, go ahead and burn the forest. Other reporting has said, yes, he has made those statements, but there's no evidence of a causal effect. There are environmental, there are weather changes, weather differences, including, in addition to climate differences. Do we have a sense of any of the causes of that 80% jump that you mentioned?
Yeah, so as we said earlier, fires are to be expected to some extent at this time of year because they're part of agricultural practice. The government has said that they've increased because the weather is dry, but that's not what scientists have said. This year isn't especially dry. And the trouble is that scientists believe that current fires are linked to deforestation. So people actually cutting down trees in natural reserves in order to use that land for agriculture. There hasn't yet been an investigation into how exactly the fires started, but research that we have up to this point has shown actually that the areas that are burning are also the areas where deforestation has been on the rise. And historically, Brazil did a good job in reducing deforestation in the mid-2000s, but in recent years, it started to increase again, even before Bolsonaro came into office, and it's been increasing even further since he stepped in.
As these fires rage, Luisa, the world watches in horror because the Amazon forest is responsible for sequestering 25% of the world's carbon load. Now, at the G7 summit, which we've been discussing, Emmanuel Macron, president of France, got people together, $20 million to aid in the fires. Ron Nixon mentioned it, a small sum, not a significant amount of money, but an international effort. And right away, before the check is cut to send to Brazil, petty feuds between Bolsonaro and other leaders. What was behind these feuds, and is the money going to flow now, and will it help?
Yeah, so this war of words between President Macron and President Bolsonaro started as soon as the problem of the fires became evident, and President Macron criticized Bolsonaro's environmental policies. Bolsonaro then replied saying that Macron didn't really want to help and is actually interested in Brazil's natural resources. Bolsonaro gives voice to a theory that's common in military circles that foreign nations work together with environmental NGOs to impinge on Brazil's sovereignty and explore the Amazon themselves. And as you said, Macron announced $20 million to help with the effort to fight the fires. And at this point, it's actually not yet clear whether Brazil will accept that because Bolsonaro has said that he would only consider it if Macron apologized for what he said. And that actually had some impact here in Brazil because some governors of states where the Amazon is have been saying that Brazil should not, be engaged in this war of words with Macron, but rather, try to rebuild the country's image in the international community because they fear that the situation could damage Brazil's agribusiness. They fear that foreign countries might impose sanctions and boycotts on Brazilian imports. And as you probably know, yesterday, American VF Corporation said that they would suspend imports of leather from Brazil until it was clear that the leather came from sustainable origins. Whether, that's going to go further is hard to say at this point. It seems that while international pressure on Brazil agribusiness is likely to pick up, Brazil farm commodities seem hard to quit buying. So.
Well, Luisa Franco, before we let you go, we appreciate you jumping on the line from Brazil. What are the immediate prospects of tamping down these fires as they continue to burn across the forest?
So firefighters are working to put out the fires as we speak. And next month, on the 6th of September, there will be a meeting of Amazonian countries in Colombia to discuss a single policy on environmental preservation and exploration rules in the region. We don't really know much about what is going to be discussed, but what scientists have been saying is that the government urgently needs to start working with researchers to find ways to develop the area in a sustainable manner.
Luisa Franco, reporter for BBC News, speaking with us from Sao Paulo in Brazil. Luisa, again, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
You're Jenny on Twitter. I beg your pardon.
It works just fine, too. I'll take it.
Jenny from The Vox, they call you.
That's me.
Jennifer, there are a few things that bring climate change and climate catastrophe into sharper focus than strong hurricanes, but burning rainforest. The international bickering continues, but the pictures are stark and the pictures are clear.
Right. And, you know, there has been a lot of conversation, and some of it in a very kind of gallows humor way that I've seen on Twitter and among some, you know, who are concerned that, you know, I saw one tweet in particular that was kind of laughing and saying, you know, okay, so what happens if we all worked to, you know, stop eating so much meat and stop using plastic straws and, you know, made sure that we were really good at putting out that recycling bin every week, and then Jair Bolsonaro just burns down the entire Amazon? And, you know, it's funny in a horrific sense that, you know, that you have all of these climate scientists who are out there trying to sound this warning about, look, we have to take steps right now. We have to take steps yesterday to try to, you know, just stave off the worst case scenarios. And there are little things that each individual can do, you know, here and there in your personal lives and in your personal consumption that you can do. But it's really, really depressing as an individual to look and go, what does my contribution have anything to do when something like this, the Amazon, which serves as a massive carbon sink, right, that helps kind of clean the air. That's what trees do. That's the point. You know, having this massive wildfires just decimating something that's such a massive part of our of controlling climate change. And it's just so horrific to just sit there and watch and go, what can you do? You know, and one of my questions to some of the climate reporters that we have at Vox has been, what can you do? Like, as an individual, is the best thing you can do just like hope to vote for the right politician that doesn't have, you know, anti-climate change views? Like, what is the most impactful thing you can do? Because I think it's really hard to watch something like this, especially from far away in the U.S. when, you know, I can't bring down the government of Brazil, I'm pretty sure, by myself. You know, what can you do besides, you know, you send $20 to the Amazon? Like, I think it's a really it's a fundamental question of what to do about climate change when you see something like this.
And brings into focus once again the same theme that we talked about at the G7. International leaders, when they get on the world stage with their domestic political priorities, often at odds with right. The interests of the countries around them and those of us who live in other countries. The State Department, the Pentagon, here in this country is one agency that has, in its own way, sounded the alarm about climate change in that military way that military brass tend to do, a threat to bases overseas, a threat to stability, a threat to economies, a threat to migration. The Defense Department has told American presidents climate change is a threat. Well, a former defense secretary is about to publish a book and has released excerpts in the Wall Street Journal. The book is called Call Sign Chaos, Learning to Lead. It is written by former defense secretary Jim Mattis, call sign Mad Dog. Now, Mattis details his hesitancy to return to Washington for the job to work for President Trump. Ron Nixon, what was the overall tone of this excerpt? It caught a lot of people's attention, as it's designed to do.
Right. I think it caught a lot of people's attention because it was the first time we had heard from Mattis since he left administration. However, I will say that I don't think there's anything in the excerpt that we saw that we read that we didn't know about already in his resignation letter. He had mentioned a lot of this already. And there's a lot of reporting while he was in the administration about his discomfort with some of the things that the administration was doing, like sending active duty troops to the border to deal with the immigration or to back up Customs Border Protection, pulling troops out of Syria. You know, all of those things we knew about before. And what he tries to do in these excerpts and then the interview with the Atlantic is to walk a middle ground here, to criticize without criticizing. It's like Bruce Lee talked about the art of fighting without fighting. So, you know, he says, well, you know, I don't want to criticize the president, but, you know, we can't go at it. America can't go it alone.
Mattis was always one of these people who was branded by people outside as an adult in the room.
Right.
Right? He's there to steward the Defense Department and guide American military policy with a commander in chief, frankly, who's hard to manage.
Right. Right. And There does appear to be some of my former colleagues when I was at the New York Times, you know, some of their reporting seems to indicate his unease with a lot of the things that was coming out of the White House. But it just seems from the excerpts that there was a red line for him that was crossed and he could no longer serve in the administration. But again, someone who believes that, well, you don't publicly criticize the commander-in-chief, even though he's criticizing the commander-in-chief.
Simon, what did you read between the lines of Jim Mattis's excerpt?
I think Washington has for months been desperate to give Jim Mattis a pass. People in the salons of Georgetown know Jim Mattis. They quite liked him before he went into the administration. They viewed him as an adult in the room, and they just can't understand. They're desperate for him to come out and tell us what he really thinks of President Trump, which he's not going to do. I think we can all surmise that he viewed President Trump the same way Rex Tillerson viewed President Trump, but he hasn't articulated it. I think, though, Jim Mattis has got some explaining to do. There's an accountability issue here. This is the man who, as Secretary of Defense, agreed to send 5,200 troops to the southern border in 2018 to shore up a blatant political move by President Trump to argue that an invasion of the country, which wasn't about to happen, was about to happen. He snapped to attention and he did it. This was the man who came out and carried Donald Trump's water over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, said that he could see no smoking gun that led to the conclusion that Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia was responsible for the dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi in that Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He doesn't get a pass. He's got explaining to do, and it goes way beyond whether he thinks Donald Trump is a moron or not.
So Jim Mattis says, my responsibility is to remain silent. I owe any president silence now. Maybe eventually you will hear from me. It sounds, Jennifer, like Simon's charge of accountability for Jim Mattis, that he knows eventually for his legacy he's going to have to, what can I say? Say what he really thinks, or tell some of the people what they want to hear about what it means to run the Pentagon under President Trump.
With all due respect to Jim Mattis, his oath that he takes is not to silence and is not to the President of the United States. It is to the U.S. Constitution to protect and defend, just like the President is. So, you know, his code of silence and his, you know, honor and respect, which I'm sure he has plenty. But as a general officer, taking an oath and serving the country in the U.S. military as a general officer, which he is before retiring, his responsibility is to the Constitution and to the American people, and to explain that, you know, whether or not he thinks the President of the United States is fit to lead as Commander-in-Chief.
Well, given the spirit and the energy of this conversation, I can make a prediction. I think that book's going to sell pretty well. They got people talking, which is the point of an excerpt in the first place.
Exactly.
Secretary Mattis, your publisher, whoever you are, well done. You got us. We're talking about it. Now, we talked a lot about climate at the beginning of this topic. It is critical. And there is a young Swedish celebrity, climate change advocate. Her name is Greta Thunberg. You've heard of her. She made her way to the United States this week by boat. She sailed across the Atlantic on a zero-emission yacht, landing in New York City to share her zest for addressing the greatest existential threat in her view, which is, of course, climate change. She was asked if she had a message for America's president.
It's strange. Everyone always asks me about Donald Trump. But, I mean, my message for him is just listen to the science, and he obviously doesn't do that. So, I mean, as I always say to this question, no one has been able to convince him about the climate crisis, the urgency, then why should I be able to do that? So I'm just going to now focus on spreading awareness, and that people in general will start caring and realize how big of a crisis this is.
Greta Thunberg on the climate crisis. I want to thank my guests around the table for joining me, Ron Nixon of the AP, Jennifer Williams, Jenny from Vox.com, and Simon Marks, President Chief Correspondent for Feature Story News. Thanks to you all. 1A senior team is Denise Couture, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Rupert Allman is our executive producer. This episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about the team, visit the website at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. This is 1A.